NFL preseason football last night. Look at this score. Cleveland beat Philadelphia 5-0. Tonight, the Packers play in Oakland. High school football last night, Burlington beat Horlick 35-21. Tonight, you can watch Bradford and Lake Geneva on Facebook Live at WGTD-FM. That's a 7 o'clock start. Over on gatewaysportsweb.org, you can hear St. Catherine and Union Grove at 6:45. The forecast from the National Weather Service, cloudy and cool, rain likely. Today's high 69. Tonight, cloudy, 60% chance of more rain. Overnight low 65. We dry out on Saturday, partly sunny and 83. Right now, 65 degrees in Racine, 67 Kenosha. Wind from the south at 9. The rain still to our west and southwest, but is moving in our direction. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11. The morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTD's morning show also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911 and newly reimagined for 2018. It's a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com.
From time to time on WGTD's morning show, we have spoken to various people involved in the fascinating work of archaeology, including some local professors from Carthage College who have been involved in archaeological digs. So I am really excited about the opportunity I have now to speak with Dr. Donald P. Ryan, who is an archaeologist and Egyptologist, a member of the Division of Humanities at Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, Washington, and his specialty is Egyptian archaeology as well as Polynesian archaeology, and knows a great deal about ancient languages and scripts. He has gone on all kinds of different expeditions, has written a number of different articles, and his new book, Beneath the Sands of Egypt, is a very interesting look at some of what he has seen and experienced and both literally and figuratively uncovered in his work. And it not only examines some of his own direct personal encounters with the ancient, but also tells the story of some of his predecessors from many decades earlier and some of the work which they did. And along the way, we end up gaining a grasp or an understanding of just how some of this work is done very differently now versus once upon a time. And that's also a very important lesson for us to learn, that as we explore the past in archaeological digs, sometimes one does it in a way which is really nothing more than plundering. And in other ways, in other settings, it can be done in a way that's very careful and very respectful and ultimately yields the most satisfying results. Again, this book is called Beneath the Sands of Egypt, Adventures of an Unconventional Archaeologist. It's published by William Morrow. And Donald P. Ryan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much.
I wonder if you could explain to our listeners the subtitle of your book, Adventures of an Unconventional Archaeologist. I guess what I'm asking is for you to explain how you are an unconventional archaeologist.
Well, I try and address archaeology from different perspectives than a lot of the other people that I work with or in the field. I can give a couple examples, might be the best way. In Egypt, I've been working in the Valley of the Kings for a number of years, And the Valley of the Kings, of course, is very famous for these big, royal, decorated tombs where the walls are covered with beautiful paintings. And you know, these are tombs of these great rulers of Egypt. But what most people don't notice or even aware of is that sprinkled amongst these big, beautifully painted royal tombs are all kinds of little tombs, and most are either just little shafts you might see filled with rubble, or they're completely covered over now. But there were tombs that were discovered maybe 100 years ago or more that are small, and they're undecorated. They were found 100 years ago or more by earlier explorers who were looking for big royal tombs, maybe with all kinds of grave goods and so forth in them. So they virtually ignored all these little tombs. Now, when I started my own project in Egypt, I wanted to try something different. And if you want to do something different, maybe find things or study things that are under the radar, so to speak, you look in little corners. You know what people are going after, and you look elsewhere. In this case, I was very intrigued by all these little depressions in the ground and these little shafts and so forth. And when I did the research on them, I found out that these were tombs, and there's a whole bunch of them. And when I started excavating these things, we're finding that some of them seem to contain royal mummies. These are probably officials. Some of them are lesser royal family members. Some of them might be the queens or princesses. So here, right under everybody's nose, in this very, very famous archaeological site, we've made all kinds of interesting discoveries by looking at the area very differently.
So what really, as much as anything, makes you an unconventional archaeologist is that you have had some maybe unconventional priorities in what you have gone looking for, or you have followed a fairly unconventional path, in a sense.
Yeah, I'd say my own personal story is sort of unusual, but it's not necessarily the way most archaeologists have gone about things. But to give you another example of trying to do things differently, we all know the ancient Egyptians were building these pyramids and these giant temples and all these extraordinary things. They're moving huge stones around and so forth. And you look at the finished product and you're utterly amazed. And a lot of people focus on studying pyramids and temples and these grandiose things. But when you look at it, there are little technologies that make it all happen that are really overshadowed by these great monuments. For example, in the book, I have a whole chapter on ancient Egyptian rope, and you think of that, and that you think that must be the most boring subject in the world. Well, you can't move a big block of stone. You can't build a pyramid unless you can drag that thing somehow. And so Egyptologists have so many wonderful objects and constructions to concentrate on, but no one was looking at the little stuff, the little technology that makes it all happen. And I think anyone who reads my book, I think by the time they're done with reading a chapter on ancient Egyptian rope, will be startled at how important this stuff is and how actually very, very interesting it is.
Sure, and startled as well that it's been a matter largely ignored. I mean, it would seem by generations of Egyptologists who should have known better, that this was indeed a very important matter worth exploring. And yet, as you say, somehow people were so caught up in the grand, majestic sort of things that we immediately think of, and just weren't stopping to think about how exploring something like the cordage, the ropes, would in itself be a really fascinating bit of exploration.
Well, some of these things kind of come to me by personal interest, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I try and follow my own interests, such as the rope thing. I have a background as a mountain climber, so I use ropes to climb mountains. I also use them to rappel down cliffs, looking for tombs or investigating this and that. And so it's a matter of personal interest. I had a professor who had a bunch of dirty old pieces of rope and said, what can you do with this? And I said, well, I'm a mountain climber. I like rope. And I studied it and found out it was very, very interesting. So in the Valley of the Kings, I've read the stories of the early explorers and the discovery of King Tut's tomb and so forth. And so that sort of drove my interest to start looking around in places like that.
Hmm. I know that when you went off to college, I believe you began first studying international relations. You say touching on history, geography, philosophy, foreign cultures, and languages, the study of international relations was a fascinating and wonderful avenue for a broad-based education. But then something came along or crossed your path, or you crossed its path, which helped sort of reawaken in you an interest you which you had had for a long time, maybe simmering on the back burner, an interest in the ancient. Tell us about your encounter with King Tut.
Well, I had this long interest in archaeology from the time I was a kid. I liked dinosaurs. I liked, you know, the whole and archaeology of in general, but Egypt in particular. So I'm reading about the discovery of King Tut's tomb. Of course, you know, that was 1922. I wasn't around back then. But in National Geographic and various books, I love that stuff. And I always did. And then, you know, you go through high school, you get distracted with this and that. And I sort of wanted to study anthropology or archaeology at the university, but I basically picked my school so I could go mountain climbing and go to college at the same time. And where I went to school, they didn't have much of an archaeology program at the time. It's Pacific Lutheran University, where I'm based now. Now they have a very good program in archaeology. But at the time, I was just taking general courses, and at one point they make you declare a major. And so I had some fantastic professors in political science and international relations. And so I said, oh, I have to declare a major. So I did that, and I got a good education and a very, very good broad-based education. But then in 1978, it was my senior year, an exhibition came to Seattle, and it was this traveling Tutankhamun, Treasures of King Tut, came to Seattle, and of course I had to go see that. When I went into that exhibition and I saw this stuff firsthand, it just lit a fire under me. And I said, oh, this is the stuff that I really, really am interested in. And when I went to graduate school, I basically changed majors and ended up doing what I'm doing now. So I went from political science to archaeology after being sort of reintroduced with this magnificent sort of jolt of inspiration.
Mm-hmm. By the way, you say also in this chapter where you kind of outline your pathway into the world of archaeology, you say at one point, archaeology probably saved my life. I think what you're referring to there is the way in which archaeology ultimately sort of dislodged you from what had been for a few years your fanatic devotion to mountain climbing, which, of course, can be a very dangerous exploit.
Well, I've lost a lot of friends mountain climbing, and I was kind of on a trajectory that I could say killed several of my friends, and they're all very, very good climbers. I climbed professionally for several years. I worked for mountain climbing schools and guide services, and just about everybody in that profession were very, very driven, not only to do a good job taking people in the mountains and instructing, but on your free time, they're out pushing their limits. And I believe I give an example in the book about one climbing school I worked for. There's only three of us that survived more or less intact. You know, four were killed doing extreme adventure stuff, and one basically had her leg crushed, and there's myself and two others that remain, as I say, more or less intact. But that's the sort of lifestyle that some of us were leading, was doing this extreme adventure stuff.
Well, and you, and as you describe it, you're using terms like addiction and obsession and fanaticism. I mean, just the way you kind of characterize some of your adventures in mountain climbing, it's a little kind of even disconcerting for us to read about the extent to which you were throwing yourself into this dangerous hobby.
Well, I should make it clear, I wasn't alone. I mean, I don't want anyone to get the idea that I'm this, you know, lone extreme adventure guy. I mean, there are a lot of people who do this kind of thing, and hopefully they survive the experience. I decided to calm down a little bit just because I was getting a lot of satisfaction out of going on archaeological adventures that weren't quite as dangerous. But at the same time, I could use some of my skills doing all this, outdoor antics. I could take into archaeology and explore some very interesting places.
It's interesting as you describe how you began your studies, graduate studies in archaeology. You said my first quarter at big university was like taking a plunge off a high board into unfamiliar and deep waters. So, I mean, you were in a sense you were leaving one scary thing behind just to sort of find another, although this was, in a sense, scary and intimidating in a whole different way. But obviously it's something with which you ultimately came to really feel comfortable and fall in love.
Well, you know, graduate school wasn't my favorite part of my life. I mean, I'd been really spoiled at Pacific Lutheran University. They pride themselves on the professors, you know, nurturing the students and looking after every individual student and so forth. And it was a relatively small school. And then I go to this big university. Even as a graduate student, I was, you know, just a very small fish in a giant pond. And then the stuff that was required was a quantum leap from my undergraduate days, in the sense that the professor would assign you 50 things to read and disappear and say, come back in a week and we'll talk about it. And, you know, it was a pretty intense experience, but it was great education I got all along the way. From the time I started university and got out of graduate school, I had a wonderful education. It wasn't always pleasant, but I think I had some splendid professors who, at least if they weren't nice, at least they were smart. So,
before we start talking about your exploits and adventures in Egypt, I want you to tell our listeners about the FBQ, the Final Bone Quiz.
Yeah.
That's something that you mention when it comes to some of the tougher experiences you had in graduate school as you first began really seriously studying archaeology.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm lucky I haven't gone through therapy for that thing. I mean, it's called a living nightmare. Well, one of the classes we had to take had to do with, you call it faunal analysis. You know, apart from finding human bones or artifacts and so forth, you study the environment in which people lived in the past. And that includes, you know, plants and animals. And I took a class in faunal analysis, which is the study of animal bones, because you find lots of those when you're, you know, digging up sites. And we had to learn all the bones in mammalian skeletons, so any kind of mammal. And we started with a cat, and every day they'd teach a new bone or two, and then they'd show you these bones that were all broken into tiny little fragments, and you had these quizzes all the time. You know, you'd find a little bone fragment, and you'd have to say, oh, it's the upper distal humerus and so forth. And after a while, you know, there's a couple hundred bones in this skeleton, and they're throwing these fragments at you. And we do these bone quizzes where you line up, and they have a piece of bone in each box. Well, at the end of the course, you've tried to learn all these bones, identify them by fragments. And so they had a thing called the FBQ, or the Final Bone Quiz, where they had 50 boxes each with fragments. Most of them were fragments. Occasionally they'd have a bone in there that was just really weird, that hard to even recognize it as a bone from some curious animal. And then they line us up, and there's a graduate student with a stopwatch, and you got 30 seconds to identify that bone and move to the next box. And then at the end, they would have some strange bone, sort of a bonus bone, and it could be something really horrible, or it could be a rubber squeaky dog toy. But you know, the students had already been through this class would try and unnerve you and tell you stories about putting the rat skeleton into a blender and picking out 50 pieces at random and so forth. But you know, it was really learn your bones well when you're tested that way, but that you almost have to have nerves of steel. You got 30 seconds, and then you have to move and move and move. And you know, that was, I don't know if other schools do that, but where I went, they were testing us all the time. So I still know those bones.
We're speaking with Donald P. Ryan, and we're talking about his book, Beneath the Sands of Egypt, Adventures of an Unconventional Archaeologist. So ultimately, your studies, you survived that first year of graduate school, and I believe it's that next summer that for the first time you are able to travel to Egypt and do some of your very first study and archaeological work in this amazing nation of Egypt. And among the really interesting observations in this first chapter is that you kind of tell us about some of the questions which most intrigued you, at least, that a lot of us kind of miss. And it has to do with how sort of the civilization in Egypt was transformed over time in terms of how people there lived and exactly when and how the Egyptian ancient civilization that we all think of, how it took place and what preceded it. Just speak for a moment of just about how complex, in fact, this history is and how it was so intriguing to you.
Well, it's very easy to focus on the big monuments that were built during the time of the pharaohs, the pyramids and temples and giant obelisks and all these things. That's what most people think about when they think about ancient Egypt. But this stuff just didn't pop out of the earth. It wasn't just the people who got together and said, let's build a pyramid. There had been people living in the Nile Valley and that whole area for tens of thousands of years. And it's more of a process of development rather than this stuff appearing overnight. So you go back far enough, and like people you find all over the world, you had hunters and gatherers, people who lived a lifestyle where they would be, you know, hunting the local creatures and gathering whatever plants and fishing. And then at one point, you have a profound lifestyle change, which in many ways is still kind of a mystery, where people settled down in one place instead of, say, following the resources around seasonally. They settled down in one place, build villages that are more or less permanent, and have agriculture and domesticated animals. And that transition is very important, because from that foundation of agriculture and maintaining animals like cows and goats and so forth, from that foundation we find in the ancient world wherever civilizations appear, it always kind of starts in places where that has occurred. So you have a couple of really important traditions, or I should say developmental stages, if you want to call it that, from just foraging-type people to the development of agriculture, and then from there in certain places like Mesopotamia and Egypt and China and in the New World in a few places, where you have these cultures that just become very complicated, and they're building big monuments like pyramids, and you have rulers, and you have, you know, craftsmen, and you have priests, and you have this whole very what anthropologists would call complex societies and what are commonly known as civilizations. So it didn't happen overnight. It was a long sort of a development process. And when you're an archaeologist, sometimes you look in the dirt and you see, oh, a bunch of stone tools, and all of a sudden, you know, 2 inches of dirt on top of that, 2 inches of dirt, and then you find, you know, a pyramid or something. Well, that 2 inches of dirt might represent a couple hundred years of development. And there are certain things, too, that archaeologists don't find necessarily in the archaeological record, and that might be guys sitting around a campfire discussing what they're going to do next. I mean, these are sort of the things that would be interesting if we could ever find, but we probably never will, where they're discussing, you know, somebody comes up with an idea, like, I can write something, or I can make this mark on a piece of paper, on a piece of clay or something, and I can use that to communicate with somebody else. So a lot of that, the clues that would really tell us how it all happens aren't there. We're basically dealing with material remains. We can't interview these people and say, well, who gave you this agriculture idea?
Well, and it's not the kind of thing people wrote extensively about, of course, in the moment. It was just sort of the stuff of life, and you have to end up sort of sifting for clues to infer, rather than, you know, uncover some tablet which lays it all out in great detail. That would be a fairly simple matter if such a thing existed.
Yeah, when you get to the time period when writing is extensive, of course you can get all kinds of interesting ideas about how people are thinking, to the extent you can understand it. I mean, even with writing, it's a matter of interpreting the words and all this sort of thing, and also the mindset of the people writing them. But prior to that, for the thousands and thousands of years of crucial development, we don't have that luxury.
Right. It doesn't exist. As you describe your first visit to Egypt, I think your experience is probably echoes that of a lot of people who see this place of amazing beauty and grandeur and majesty and of course great historical importance, and yet all of that is set in rather jarring contrast to the intensely entrepreneurial sort of commercial nature of a lot of the people there. Who often are engaging in really shady tactics and who pass themselves off as knowledgeable guides when in fact they're nothing of the kind, and trying to find all kinds of different ways to capitalize on tourists who don't know any better. Say a word about what I'm talking about and some of your own encounters with this reality in modern Egypt, a reality which is probably present in other such places around the world.
Well, you know, millions of tourists go to Egypt, and any time you have you know, big tourist places like Cairo or Luxor, everybody wants to go and see the antiquities. So you have kind of you have people who make their living trying to relieve you of your money, and in various clever ways. I must say that Egypt's a very safe place. I don't think anyone's ever going to jump you in an alley or knock you on the head, or you know, I think any kind of theft is very rare, but people who work the tourists are going to talk you out of your money in very clever ways. So you might go to the pyramids, and someone will come up to you and try and drag you into a perfume shop or tell you to get on a camel, and it's $5, but it's another $5 to get off the camel. I mean, it's a lot of little stunts like that. But I need to emphasize that that's the minority of the people in Egypt. That first experience to me in Egypt on an expedition, we lived in a rural part of Egypt. They had barely seen any foreigners regularly, and these were sweet, honest, wonderful people, and that constitutes the majority of the Egyptians. And unfortunately, some people go to Egypt, and these rascals will come out at Luxor, one of these places. They're trying to sell you stuff. They're trying to take you around. And some of them, some of them are okay. Some will take you on a nice little personal tour of the monuments, but some of them don't know a darn thing, which I describe in my book. So I had a real, real mixed experience. I love being out in the countryside. The average Egyptian is out there working in the fields just as their ancestors did, or engaging in local enterprises. But at the tourist places, you're gonna find, some people that are pretty obnoxious. Mm-hmm. But even some of them are very good natured.
Hmm. Tell us also how things changed in terms of free access to some of these. For instance, like the pyramids and so on. I believe you describe how this starts to change even between your first and second visit to Egypt.
Well, there's never been totally free access. The Antiquities Service supports itself by charging tickets to the monuments. So if you want to go to the Valley of the Kings, for example, they have a ticket booth, and you buy a ticket that will allow you to go into, I think it's three tombs right now. You want to go in the museum, you buy a ticket. So everything is right now is pretty much ticketed. The Egyptians don't necessarily want people just walking everywhere they want across the desert and climbing pyramids and doing all this kind of stuff. They look at their antiquities as precious commodities that need to be preserved. There's a long history of thievery and damage to the monuments, especially over the last few hundred years. And they're very cautious and conservative about where you can go and what you can do out in the desert or wherever.
We're speaking with Donald Ryan about his book, Beneath the Sands of Egypt, Adventures of an Unconventional Archaeologist. We should talk a moment about what you were just touching on now, the centuries in which so many of these tombs have been robbed, plundered, and what a challenge that ends up being then for people like you who explore these tombs today. I mean, beyond the obvious, which is that, of course, certain things have been carried off that we wish so much that we could see now, and other things destroyed or terribly damaged, probably in many cases beyond recognition. But on top of that is just the matter also that in many cases it makes it incredibly confusing to figure out when you go into a tomb, what here dates from when this tomb was created versus what is just the refuse left behind by grave robbers. Talk about that and what a challenge that poses for you and other archaeologists.
Well, most of the tombs, let's say tombs specifically, one might find today in Egypt have been robbed. Robbed in antiquity, if not in the last 200 years. But some of the tombs that I've dealt with, they've been robbed maybe even a couple times in ancient times. And the ancient robbers were looking for certain things. They weren't looking for art pieces to put on, sell in the underground art market or sell as antiquities to museums or whatever. They were looking for recyclable materials. So they'd go into one of these tombs, and there'd be big jars of oils, expensive oil. They'd take that out and put it in a different container and sell it. They're looking for precious metals. And some of these coffins in the more elite tombs would have gold on the outside. And so we would find near the entrance of the tombs busted up coffin fragments where the robbers would drag these coffins out near the doorway where there was enough light to see what they were doing, and they'd smash them up and scrape the gold off. So we find little gold flakes near the entrance of the tomb, and sometimes stuck to little pieces of wood where they had smashed up these gilded objects. And then they could take that down and melt it down. And some of these tombs had lots of linen in it, and you can cut the little tags off of it, and no one knows where it comes from. And so they're looking for recyclable items. Of course, you don't want to get caught because the penalties were very harsh. We know that because there are some surviving texts that talk about the trial of some tomb robbers, and the penalties are very harsh, things like impaling and burning alive and such. So these guys were pretty bold, and they go in and take what they could and then try and make it anonymous and sell it. Now, you go forward in time, the culture changed. Ancient Egyptian culture pretty much transformed itself almost out of existence in terms that the religion and became forgotten and the writing system and so forth. And we have Christianity and Islam and the Arabic language coming to Egypt. And I'd say for a couple thousand years or a thousand and a half, the antiquities of Egypt were basically ignored, other than you need a block of stone or a piece of stone to put in your house for a wall, or you needed some firewood, you'd just go out to the antiquities and find a coffin and burn it, or take a block of stone, and really not much concern for it. But then Europeans started showing up about 200 years ago, fascinated by Egypt's past. Then a real market developed for finding antiquities. And you could go to Egypt 150 years ago and buy a mummy and its coffin, probably for not very much. And there seemed to be an endless supply of them because these villagers who lived near these cemeteries would say, hey, somebody wants this junk in our backyard. Well, we're going to get it for them. And so there was a real market for this stuff. So tomb robbing really picked up in the 19th century.
I thought it was interesting, too, and this story comes in the chapter called Frisking the Dead, in which you describe the exploits of just one archaeologist by the name of David Hogarth, who did exploration in the very early 20th century. And I'm not sure, but I think this is someone who is not particularly renowned. Fairly obscure, and you actually helped to kind of uncover some of the work which he did, and particularly some of the journals he kept about some of the things that he explored in Egypt. One of the things that he did, and I don't think this was unique to him, is the way in which he would pay bonuses for some of the Egyptians who were working for him and assisting in these archaeological digs. It looks like it's the bakshish system. But you tell us about how this would sometimes lead to a practice known as salting,
right,
which I've never heard of before. But, oh, this is yet another way in which all this gets a little more complicated. Tell our listeners what salting refers to.
Well, this thing, bakshish system. Bakshish basically means a tip. And this was something people tried, you know, 100 years ago, and including some very prominent archaeologists. The idea was that you had a crew of workmen, sometimes a big crew of workmen, and when they're digging, they're doing a lot of the digging for you. They're filling baskets full of sand. They're going to find little objects. And so the idea is that you pay them for the small objects rather than them taking them, you know, off somewhere and selling them to somebody else. So basically you're buying back your own antiquities from your dig. Of course, if it's something big, they're not going to be able to move it, but it was for trying to keep the workmen from being tempted to pocket stuff and sell them elsewhere. But then you'd have this practice they call salting, where they would show up with antiquities. Maybe they found it in their backyard or they found it somewhere, and then they plant them. And so then they pull it out of the sand and say, looky here, look what I found. How about some bakshish? So that system mean, that's certainly, people don't do that anymore. I mean, the rules are completely different. I mean, the rules have changed so much in the last 100 years. It's very well controlled now. There's no one allowed to steal, do anything. You can't pay people for their fines and this kind of thing. But it was a strategy that some people believed in. I personally think it's kind of ridiculous, but I understand the philosophy behind it.
Hmm. When you would come to a particular tomb, for instance, as you describe the work you did in Tomb 60, you talk about how the moment that you essentially open the tomb is thrilling, but that initial excitement turns to the chore of routine archaeological documentation. You say it becomes time to carefully go through this tortured mess of a burial and try to make sense of its pieces. It can't be done hastily. The archaeologist has but one chance to do it right. Explain what you're talking about there.
What a lot of people, I don't think, realize is that archaeology is actually a kind of destructive practice. Let's say you're digging a mound. Underneath it, there's a grave or there's something under there. When you, the very act of dismantling or excavating a site, you're taking it apart. It's never going to be back together the way it was. And you realize that it's your job to make sure that you document as much as possible as it was as found. We call that documentation in situ. It's so important because you have one chance to do it. Let's say this Tomb 60 you mentioned. We go into this tomb, and it had been savagely robbed in ancient times. And the floor of this tomb is covered with all kinds of broken bits of burial furniture, and there's a mummy in there and all sorts of stuff. Well, if we want to get the most information out of this tomb, we need to know, where is everything located? What's it located next to? It might be associated with something. And the very context, the physical context of these objects, where they are found in place, needs to be documented so we can get the most amount of potential information out of them. Because once we pick it up, it's no longer in its ancient context. And I suppose you could all drag it out and stick it back. It's generally not what we do. We pick up the pieces, and then we can study them and conserve them. And some of them maybe will go on display for the enjoyment of the public. So an archaeologist's excavation is, in a sense, it's destructive in the sense that you are taking apart the original ancient context in which an object was placed or ended up in one way or another.
One of the things that's intriguing is how complicated all this is, even in terms of just what tomb is this that I am exploring, or where is the door to this tomb that somebody found maybe 100 years earlier, and which now I am all these years later trying to discover again. And a lot has to do with how carefully and accurately some of those determinations were made once upon a time. I mean, just say a word about this matter of numbering the tombs and sort of outlining where they are, because I think a lot of us sort of miss that whole level of complexity in all this.
Well, in terms of going out and looking for lost tombs, step A is doing your homework. So in places like the Valley of the Kings, I was interested in these small undecorated tombs that people had found and ignored because they weren't big and pretty. And looking into that involved going to archives and looking at their notes and reading everything possible about the area where these tombs were located and what these explorers saw. And then you combine that with actually going out there to the sight and with these explorers' notes and comments in your head, looking at the landscape and coming up with ideas about these places. And sometimes the notes are very obscure, or some of these tombs are so damaged, or they're full of flood debris, or they're full of junk that has blown in there over the years, or they're completely obscured. You can't even see the entrance of them. And that's where all these notes and things come in. In terms of identifying them, the tombs I've excavated in the Valley of the Kings have no decorations on the walls. You can't just go in there and read the walls and it'll have the name of a pharaoh and like so many of the big decorated tombs in the immediate vicinity. These little tombs are completely, the walls are completely blank. So you have a real problem. You can go in these tombs and try and discover who they belong to. Well, we find the remains of mummies in there, and we might be able to tell you it's male or female and so forth. But we have to use every technique in the book to try and make sense of these tombs. Egyptologists are somewhat spoiled because so many of these tombs are covered with beautiful paintings. You just walk in there and read the wall, and it'll tell you whose tomb it is. But these little undecorated tombs can be little mysteries. The fact that they're undecorated in and of itself is a mystery, is why do you have these little tombs scattered amongst the big royal tombs where all the other little tombs on the other side of the hill of officials and so forth are beautifully decorated as well, but these are not, and they have, in some of them, what appear to be royal mummies in them.
Hmm. And again, because you find yourself drawn to these particular sorts of tombs, you are then drawn to some of the most challenging mysteries of them all. And I wonder, in our closing couple of minutes, if you can just speak to what's kind of one of the most disconcerting things about all this, and that is, of course, that these tombs were created with no sense that people would be entering them thousands and thousands of years later, sometimes as robbers carting off treasures, and sometimes as scientists coming in to explore. How do you, as someone who enters these tombs on a regular basis, how do you kind of reconcile yourself to exactly where you are and exactly what you're doing?
Well, that's actually a very legitimate philosophical question, and it's one I pose to my students sometime. Is it okay for me to go and dig up your grandmother? This sort of question. In the case of Egypt, we're dealing with stuff that's very, very, very old. There's no one alive who could probably point to a single ancient Egyptian tomb and say, that was my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. So there is a bit of distance between the living and the people we're excavating. Those tombs were built to last for eternity, and those burials were built or established for eternity. In the case of the tombs I excavated, they're mostly woefully robbed. And what I like to think is that when I am done with my work, the tomb has been restored to some extent to its previous dignity. If I have my way, the human remains are left in the tomb. Sometimes that's not my option, but that's what I prefer. You go in these tombs and they're damaged, or their grave goods are torn up, and by the time we're done, there's some sort of order and dignity left to the tomb. One of the ancient Egyptian beliefs was one's eternal existence had to do with preservation of a mummy, which served as a home for the soul, had to do with hopefully keeping your name alive. Your name sort of has an existence of its own. And I'd say that we do our part, especially with the tombs that are badly robbed, to fulfill those kind of goals in their own way.
Coming up at 9 o'clock, support for the morning show comes from Carthage.